Texas becomes one of the first states making moves toward a post-COVID-19 lockdown. Too fast, too soon? That story and a whole lot more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Governor Abbott, flanked by other top officials, announces schools will remain closed in Texas, but a task force is working on getting back to business as usual. We'll discuss what happens next with House Speaker Dennis Bonin. Also, the Texas engineers ramping up to help offset a shortage of hospital ventilators. And a book by a Texan who survived a pandemic 100 years ago and resonates today. All that and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 20th day of April, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Hope you had a good weekend, even though the days seemed to run together for many folks. The yearning for a return to some degree of normalcy had many Texans out and about on Sunday trying to take advantage of the spring-like weather across much of the Lone Star State this past weekend. But the fallout from COVID-19 continues apace. Reuters reports the first major U.S. department store set to declare bankruptcy due to the financial impact of the lockdown. We're talking about Dallas-based Neiman Marcus. They're set to file papers this week. The impact on everyday Texans, profound too. More than 4,000 vehicles were lined up at NRG Stadium in Houston on Saturday to accept free groceries being distributed by the Houston Independent School District, the Chronicle reports. The backup was so large, the line opened 3 hours earlier than posted and stayed open until 6:30 at night. On Sunday, state data showed a 4% increase over the previous day in coronavirus cases in Texas to approximately 19,000. Harris County and Dallas County, the hardest hit. In that same period, a 5% increase in the number of COVID-19-related fatalities, bringing the statewide total to just under 500 lives lost to COVID-19 in Texas. But Texas was making news nationwide this weekend as among the first states to announce a phased-in reopening. On Friday, after we went off the air, Governor Abbott said that although schools will remain closed for the academic year, state parks will begin reopening their gates today, to be followed by partial reopening of retail stores and a loosening of surgery restrictions. At his news conferences throughout this crisis, Governor Abbott's been flanked by Texas House Speaker Dennis Bonin, who joins us now on The Standard. Speaker Bonin, welcome.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, today, the plan that Governor Abbott outlined on Friday begins to roll out. We have state parks reopening today. But there are some experts and models that suggest that Texas won't hit a kind of peak in this coronavirus pandemic until early May. Is there a danger, do you think, that this is all too soon, the reopening of Texas?
Well, let's be clear. Texas isn't fully and completely reopened. Simply, parks were reopened today with some significant restrictions, like you can't be with anyone who isn't your family member. You can't be in groups larger than five. You must be social distancing. You need to be wearing masks. And so I think that the governor is showing great care in providing Texans some outlets and relief from staying at home, which is still in effect. The stay-at-home order is still in effect through the end of the month. And so it's simply taking these steps forward, candidly, to see how well Texans can manage these things and not create a spike in cases. The reality of it is Texans are still in great control of how quickly we can get businesses back open and get Texas's economy back to full speed. And it's really going to be based on how well we heed the CDC guidelines, how well we listen to the executive orders of the governor moving forward, that are going to be providing opportunities to get Texans back to their normal activities. But we can't quit social distancing. We can't quit regularly washing our hands. We've got to keep doing these things so that this will be successful and we can get back to a more normal life.
Now, I know that you have been critical of some folks who have been taking advantage of the fact that police, for example, aren't, you know, pulling people over if they're, you know, out and about and that kind of thing. In fact, I think you have a T-shirt on your website, Don't Be an Ass, which you're using the proceeds from to help benefit, you know, some of the food banks and food pantries and that kind of thing. The reason I'm asking this is because, as you're aware, over the weekend there was a protest outside the Capitol. Not a whole lot of social distancing there, not very many masks. What is your sense of those protests calling for state officials to let up on these stay-at-home orders?
Well, the reality of it is it's their right to express their opinions and to protest. That's what makes America and Texas great. But this is usually, you know, you're going to always have a protester here and there. And I think that out of 29 million Texans, to have about 200 of them show up and, you know, not follow a single guideline and say they're outraged, I'd say the percentages are pretty much in the favor of the rest of Texans who take this seriously, want to get back to a normal life, want to get back to business, but want to do it the right way and understand that we have to keep heeding these CDC guidelines so that we can get to a recovery. The reality of it is there are people in this world who have responsibility, and there are those who don't. And Governor Abbott has the responsibility of whether Texans get sick from this virus, whether Texans unfortunately die. And it's hard when you're responsible, and it demands leadership, which the governor has shown, and it demands hard decisions. And when you're not responsible, you can go protest with your children and not social distance and not wear a mask and do whatever the hell you feel like. But the reality of it is, thank God in Texas we have a responsible governor who's doing the best he can to lead our state to a health care recovery and an economic recovery.
I get a sense, and I think a lot of other Texans are getting this sense too, that we're reaching, though, a critical point when it comes to the economy. I mean, there are some struggling hospitals in parts of the state where there's been a ban on non-essential medical procedures, and a lot of the surgeries that used to pay for keep those hospitals afloat, it's causing some real economic hardship. I understand on Wednesday there will be a loosening on the ban for non-essential medical procedures. What does that entail, and what about the issue of abortion there?
Well, what it entails is, again, it leaves the discretion to the doctors. And so, again, Governor Abbott and the strike force that's been created are trying to get our economy back open and trying to do it in a responsible way to the healthcare concerns that we're dealing with, and making sure that those hospitals, small rural hospitals, some in urban settings, are able to be economically viable while being conscientious and safe from a healthcare standpoint. So they're going to have a loosening of the restrictions on the elective surgeries. Again, one of the mistakes that was made during this entire time is that, quite candidly, doctors had discretion. And I think a lot of people just got nervous and scared and just said, well, let's just not do any. Always doctors had the ability to make a decision about what was medically necessary and do an elective surgery if they found it necessary. That is, even greater discretion is given to the doctors starting this week. They're able to do those procedures. And the reality of it is they are going to be required to have, for the elective procedures, you know, they've got to be able to cover their own PPEs. It's mm-hmm. never been the state's responsibility or the federal government's responsibility to provide a hospital with PPEs to do their operations. And so as long as a hospital, a medical office can provide PPEs and safely conduct business and do these procedures, they are free to go forward and do those things as long as they can do it safely.
Was the non-essential, I mean, initially, Ken Paxton, the state attorney general, had weighed in on abortions being non-essential. Where does that stand now?
That would continue, you know, that's, I believe, in the courts, and that would continue a lot of doctor discretion on that. You know, those of us that are pro-life don't believe that that's a grand idea. And quite candidly, I don't think it's something that, you know, obviously you have to consider the life of the mother, the baby. But this order continues to leave the decision making with a doctor. And that is a legal issue that they, I believe, are adjudicating in the courts as we speak.
We got this task force that the governor is setting up to determine, you know, when and in what sort of stages and phases the state can be reopened eventually. What if local governments or cities or mayors don't feel like they can adhere to the timetable that the governor comes up with? Will the governor's orders preempt what those state and local communities want to do, or what? How are y'all thinking about that?
Well, first off, through the strike force, there is great communication that will occur and has occurred with local communities. And the strike force's goal was to listen to the medical professionals and make decisions that are best for all Texans and all communities, with those communities having input. The goal would not be to have a situation where there is a big legal question of who has authority, whether it's an executive order the governor has made or whether it's a local community. Because the goal of the strike force is to get to the Texas economy opened safely with the advice of medical professionals and with the support of local officials feeling comfortable that they have the resources necessary to get their local economies going again and get people back to a normal life. So the goal is to not have counter positions and not have battles between local and state. The goal is to work together and have everybody understand the healthcare needs and that they are met, and that it is safe, and that the medical experts agree with the decisions that are being made, and therefore Texas can carry forward getting its economy back to business.
We've been speaking with Texas House Speaker Dennis Bonin. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes out of your schedule to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Be safe.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar joins us once again on this Monday. How you doing, Wells?
Doing okay, David. Doing all right. You know, we're hearing from friends and listeners about many of the issues the strike force to open Texas is contemplating as it mulls the state's economic response to COVID-19. As we heard in your talk with House Speaker Dennis Bonin, the governor announced all schools will stay closed for the remainder of the school year. Some changes to existing prohibitions like reopening state parks being made, but those broader answers as to when a wider reopening is safe remain to be seen. Via Facebook, Martha Wood says the plan seems like a fair compromise. I'm pleasantly surprised that Governor Abbott put together such a reasonable plan. Meanwhile, Benny Tisdale, citing Texas' position as the worst or near worst state in terms of testing per capita, says this is the last place that should be thinking about opening up anything. And lastly, Melissa Wilbanks Laurel adds that opening certain industries may help some people, which I'm glad for as long as safety measures are in place. But as long as schools and some childcare facilities are closed, parents are in a no-win situation. Speaking of parents, David, I heard you and the speaker talking there about that protest over the weekend. Families there with children. Lots of folks chiming in about that on social media as well. I'll be back with some of those reactions later in today's broadcast.
Yeah, taking a look at Graham May futures contract for U.S. crude oil, looking at $10.83 a barrel. That would mark the lowest close for front-month contracts since December 1998. It's one of many stories that's developing and that we continue to watch here on the Texas Standard. Keep us posted with what's going on in your part of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We've been talking about steps the state's taking toward reopening. Governors promising the approach will come in phases. But for many in the food and beverage industries and the hundreds of thousands laid off, the return to normal can't come soon enough. KERA's Bill Zeeble has been talking with the head of the Texas Restaurant Association.
Emily Williams-Knight says even though Texas restaurants have been able to keep operating on a takeout basis only, too many may still starve to death if they can't reopen soon.
We were projecting early on that we would lose between 20 and 25% of our restaurants in Texas. We have now uncovered that it wasn't working for restaurants. So we're projecting unless relief comes in and unless the governor and his team are able to open us effectively, that we could lose north of 35% of our restaurants across the state.
Knight says last week her association unveiled the Texas Restaurant Promise, a plan to safely reopen restaurant dining rooms to eager paying customers. She says her organization takes the plan to the governor's strike force today.
It's tough to bring people back when you still can't open your doors. So it's this double whammy of a massive hit to employees, especially for Dallas-Fort Worth, but also with not knowing when we can bring them back safely and have the work for them.
Knight says just a few months ago, before COVID-19, Texas boasted at least 50,000 establishments employing 1.4 million people, turning $70 billion in sales. Since COVID-19, 350,000 industry employees have lost their jobs. I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a health and safety-focused workers' compensation provider, reminding Texans that the best way to stick together right now is to stay apart. More at texasmutual.com/coronavirus.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Not enough test kits, not enough hospital beds, a big part of the narrative during this crisis, to be sure. As we've been learning, some extra fabric fashioned just the right way can substitute for a mask in many situations. The shortage of ventilators, well, that one's not so easily solved. But the Texas Standard's Laura Rice has been talking with several Texas engineers who are working to do just that.
Really, we were just sitting at home watching the news, and we saw that Italy news report, and the doctors had to decide, between who got oxygen, who got a ventilator, and who lived and who died. And we decided, that we could do something about it.
Raghav Upadhyay and his roommate are recent biomedical engineering students living in Austin. They decided they could design a ventilator. Ventilators are breathing machines. They deliver air to the lungs, and before this current pandemic, were most often used when someone had something like a severe case of pneumonia.
It's a Ferrari. It's a $30,000 machine that's in hospital rooms and ICU beds, and it can do all these fancy things, and there's so many settings that you can control, but really what you need is something like a 94 Camry.
So Upadhyay and others are trying to create just that, a simpler, low-cost breathing machine that could help keep people alive, while other researchers work on longer-term solutions like a vaccine.
Keep a patient, when they're waiting for a big ventilator, stable and comfortable until one can be available.
Amy Kovalowicz is the director of an emergency ventilator project at Rice University. Usually, she's in charge of a lab there that serves hundreds of students. But, of course, there are no students at Rice right now.
And so our user base went down to zero.
But just as it looked like there was no work for Kovalowicz to do, Rice started getting calls. The callers were tipped by Google search results that some Rice students had built a ventilator substitute.
Those students had already graduated and moved on, but people started reaching out to us saying, can we make one? Do you know how we can get a hold of one of these?
So they got to work. So did a team at the University of Texas at Austin. It's actually part of a whole brand new ventilator consortium led by a doctor at a California university.
A bunch of groups, both in industry and in academia, trying to figure out how we could put our minds together to address what we've been seeing in the news.
Aydin Zahedivash is a UT Austin student engineer on that project. He says, like at Rice, opportunity emerged as the new normal did.
I think the current effort is really a result of a lot of people having their businesses, disrupted by the crisis.
That's what happened for Adam Saleh.
I have been working with a startup that recently furloughed all its employees, and since then, I've had a lot of time being quarantined to work on this project.
He and his roommate, Raghav Upadhyay, are what you might call the lone wolves of ventilator design right now.
We have done this from our living room.
Though Upadhyay is still a current master's student at UT, they aren't affiliated with a big lab or research team.
Yeah, it's kind of two couches, a drill, some wood, a bunch of circuit equipment, motors, and that's it, Amazon Home Depot boxes.
While the setups are all a little different, the basic designs for these stopgap ventilators have some commonalities. They all take advantage of a relatively simple and cheap medical device that already exists and is readily available, the bag valve mask, or ambu bag.
These ambu bags are standard across hospitals and outpatient facilities and ambulances.
Like a ventilator, they get air into the lungs, but they're pumped by hand, not a machine. The challenge is to make them automatic. Amy Kovalowicz's team at Rice is using a 3D printer and laser cutter to make parts to automate the bag pumping.
We designed it in a way that somebody who has intermediate to advanced skills and access to the type of equipment we were using, they could build one fairly quickly.
Meanwhile, the UT team discovered a windshield wiper motor could do the compressing. Coincidentally,
really what you need is something like a 94 Camry.
They settled on one from a Camry, albeit a newer one.
That's right. It is a Toyota Camry motor from a 2016 Camry.
Aydin Zahedivash says that's because of the Camry's ample supply chain. The next step for all the teams is testing. Anything that's going to be used here in the U.S. would need federal approval or at least emergency authorization. But this is a pandemic, literally translating to a worldwide outbreak.
And some low-resource areas may make one just because, out of desperation, this is the only tool that they may have.
And it's those low-resource areas that Austin roommates Adam Saleh and Raghav Upadhyaya say their design might especially serve well. That's because it can be recharged with a hand crank if the power is out or unreliable.
My family personally is from India, and Adam's family is from Lebanon. So both of those regions are pretty underdeveloped in terms of medical, you know, devices and power grids.
The designs are all a little different. But even as the teams are working separately, they say they're also sharing their findings to help others on the same path.
Like, I'd rather have too many people working on a solution than too little, and then it being a problem down the line. I think we've all kind of benefited from each other.
And they've all benefited from the work itself.
I didn't imagine having a stay-at-home, work-at-home order would ultimately have us working double. But the motivation's there. The morale is really high. Everyone is super dedicated. We're tired. But then again, like, it's really been a nice distraction to feel like we're not just sitting at home do nothing, that we're actually trying to help.
Having enough of these ventilator substitutes isn't going to end this pandemic, but it could help save lives while we're in the midst of it. And even if things drastically improve before these models become widely available, the mad rush this time could prevent a mad rush next time. I'm Laura Rice for the Texas Standard.
Well, the clock is fast approaching the bottom of the hour, which is to say 29 minutes past. We got the Texas Roundup just around the corner. Want to stick around for that?
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Plummeting oil prices amid the coronavirus pandemic are taking their toll on Texas energy companies. Houston-based Halliburton, the nation's largest oilfield service company, posted a $1 billion net loss in the first quarter today. President Jeff Miller says they're cutting $1 billion in overhead and other costs.
We know that the industry will recover. It may look different when it does, but we believe the actions we are taking will ensure that we are in a strong position, financially and structurally, to take advantage of the market's eventual recovery.
Halliburton has also furloughed 3,500 employees at its Houston headquarters until June. The mayor of the largest city in Texas says the key to reopening the economy is widespread COVID-19 testing. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner spoke with CNN Sunday.
Let me just say this. I've gone through some major hurricanes since I've been mayor. Went through Hurricane Harvey. You can look at the radar and you can see where the storm is, when it's going to hit, and when it has left your city. With this virus, it's a different challenge. The way you see it is through testing.
Turner added Houston needs more supplies for testing. Meanwhile, Houston-born superstar Beyoncé is raising awareness about the coronavirus's disproportionate impact on African Americans. She highlighted the issue during Saturday's One World Together at Home benefit concert.
A recent report from my home city, Houston, Texas, it showed that COVID-19 deaths within Houston city limits, 57% of fatal cases are African American.
preliminary data from the CDC shows 30% of COVID-19 patients in the U.S. are African American. It's the start of peak bird migration in Texas this week, as KUT's Mose Bouchel reports a new project is underway to figure out how people can help birds avoid crashing into buildings while traveling through the state.
The Cornell Lab of Ornithology is studying the impact of lights out programs that encourage building and homeowners to dim their lights at certain times of the evening during peak migration. The lab's Julia Wang says birds, like insects, can be easily distracted by lights.
And when that happens, they're vulnerable to collisions with buildings around them, or even just becoming exhausted and confused and becoming vulnerable to other urban threats like cats or toxins.
Wang says researchers hope to monitor bird collisions by counting bird deaths and comparing those numbers to satellite images of light pollution to see how lights out programs can make a difference. Though the research is being complicated by the COVID-19 pandemic, she says a study will start in Houston, Dallas, and Fort Worth. But researchers hope the Lights Out program grows statewide and are encouraging everyone to participate.
Mose Bouchel reporting, and I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As we continue to adjust to a world under lockdown, there's been a whole lot of discussion of the influenza epidemic that gripped the United States in 1918, eventually killing some 670,000 people in this country. For a peek inside that long-ago virus, it may be worth picking up a slim novel written in 1939 by Texas author Catherine Ann Porter. Here for a look back at what that novel might tell us is Michael Agresta, who writes for Texas Monthly. Michael, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Pale Horse, Pale Rider, a very famous book, but it's actually, I suppose, more properly speaking, three small novels or novellas, right? I mean, she didn't like that term.
Yeah, she had a problem with the word novella. It's unclear why. She preferred either long story or short novel. And yeah, what I'm talking about in my article, Pale Horse, Pale Rider, is just one of those short novels that were included in the volume Pale Horse, Pale Rider that mm-hmm. she released. So, leaving aside those other two short novels that are not related to the 1918 flu, this one is very much based on her experience as a survivor of that flu. She had a very high fever, came very close to death, and wrote about it in a fictionalized way.
Porter was born in Indian Creek, Texas, and she grew up in Kyle. Texas State University now maintains her childhood home there. But it's worth noting that this novel is set in Denver, right? And that's where she experienced the Spanish flu, as it was called then, right?
Yeah, she was a young newspaper writer. She just moved to Denver recently when she came down with the flu.
Nowadays, people call it the 1918 flu because there's no indication that it actually came from Spain, that was a kind of artifact of the times and a world at war, really.
Yeah, much like today, there was a lot of interest in blaming it on different people and different nationalities. It very well might have come from the United States, unclear. In the book, in Porter's book, you read about people blaming it on the Germans, who were the enemy in World War I, enemy of the United States, saying that they'd, released germs in Boston Harbor or something like that. It's a glimpse into misinformation of that era.
Tell us a little bit about her experience and why you see it as relevant right now.
So she was so near death that funeral arrangements were actually made for her. The legend is that her curly black hair turned entirely white from her high fever experience. She was 28 years old. So to the extent that it's an autobiographical novel, she walks us through this experience of a female protagonist who goes through this hospitalization in a very overcrowded hospital and really writes quite movingly, quite compellingly. It's almost sort of psychedelic, this fever experience as she's sort of seeing things, imagining things, and having a near-death experience is the only way to describe it.
Well, what is it that you think that modern-day readers could extract from what we're currently experiencing and what she experienced?
You know, I was reading this last month as the anxiety was really building around the current pandemic. But before even some of the bad news we've gotten out of out of New York and other parts of the country. For me, it was meaningful to just to have that experience, a sort of cathartic experience of moving through the full up and down of a pandemic curve, as we've learned to think about it. You know, when you're just wondering how bad it might get, there's something to following characters in a novel as they go through the entire experience and having some of that sort of emotional release of just having an ending at all. That to me was pretty moving.
Do you think that there's, I mean, often you end a story and wonder, okay, so is there a redemptive message here? Or is it, or do you think she was making a sort of a more somber, serious statement about the state of humanity? I mean, what do you take away from it? You sounds like you were somewhat encouraged by the fact that we've been here before and survived it.
Yeah, like I said, you know, this old ancient Greek concept of catharsis, you know, that can be really relieving at a point in our present pandemic when we just don't know what's going to happen. We have all these bottled up emotions. We're hoping that the worst won't happen and we won't have to grieve and to the extent that people in other parts of the world have here in Texas. Maybe we might be spared that. You know, that would be wonderful. But there's something nice about being able to go through those emotions with these characters and just let a little bit of that out, have, you know, experience the emotions for the characters that we might be, you know, holding back in our real lives.
We've been talking about a novel written in 1939 by Texas author Catherine Ann Porter called Pale Horse, Pale Rider. Michael Agreste has been writing about this for Texas Monthly. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Michael, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on The Standard. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
My name is Umar Muhammad, and I'm in seventh grade. I'm 12 years old. So, I was studying the coronavirus genome, and I came across this concept called DNA music, which basically means, like, you take a DNA sequence and you turn it into music. So I thought, why not make some music out of the coronavirus genome? The coronavirus genome, it's made of four letters, also called nucleotides. So the four nucleotides are A, U, G, and C. And to make music out of them, each nucleotide in the genome, or each letter in the genome, you could say, I turned each one into a specific note. Now that I'm not in school, my teacher assigned me a project that we called the Passion Project, and in that, we basically research whatever we want. So I have always had like a really big passion in genetics, where I thought, like, why not squeeze some extra time into research? Like, the thing that's going on right now, the reason that we're out of school right now is because of the coronavirus, so why not research it? One interesting thing that I learned about the coronavirus was that its proteins are so specialized to create like the most havoc in the human body as possible. Like, for example, there's one protein called the envelope protein. It is specifically designed to like cause inflammation in the human body. And there's like other proteins which trick the human body into thinking that the virus isn't a threat. And it's just very interesting, like how all these systems work together in the virus. Like, it's such a tiny thing, but it's like almost like tailor-made to cause havoc. It's not like your typical music that you hear. It's not exactly enjoyable, it's just interesting to me that it creates rhythms. Like, it almost seems like a random mix of letters, like the genome. It almost seems like a random combination of letters. Once you turn them into music, they actually like sound just slightly pleasing, but I wouldn't expect to hear this at a party. Like, There's obviously much better music that would be played there, but still, I find it more interesting than melodious. I am Umar Muhammad, in 7th grade, 12 years old, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The pandemic has led to a panic and a government overreach of power. That was the message that dozens of Texans, what the New York Times described as a modest-sized crowd, tried to send Texas officials on Saturday in a protest under overcast skies at the state capitol. It was titled the You Can't Close America Rally in Austin, one of several similar demonstrations in the capital cities of Indiana, Maryland, and Nevada over the weekend, reflecting a growing discontentment over so-called stay-at-home orders and a challenge to their lawfulness. Masks and social distancing at the Austin rally, not so much, though lots of pro-Trump signs and chants of let us work. There were lots of state troopers and police officers wearing N95 masks, but the rally was described as peaceful and no arrests were made. As it happens, and as we've been reporting all this hour, Texas is one of a handful of states actually taking early steps aimed at reopening, albeit a move that the governor says will be phased in and measured. Is there any good way to gauge how Texans at large are feeling about trying to resume old life routines right now? Houston Public Media's Laura Isensee reports.
The prospect of returning to some kind of normal has a lot of Texans on an emotional roller coaster. I asked people around Houston to send me voice memos with their reactions.
I just worry that we're doing this too soon.
I'm excited about the state reopening, provided it can be done reasonably and safely using common sense.
What worries me is how some people don't follow recommendations from CDC.
The thought of reopening the economy terrifies me. It's hard to say no when it's your paycheck on the line.
I think the uncertainty is what's really stressful. The fact that now we see that light at the end of the tunnel, it gives me hope.
That was Dries Bergman, Melissa Stewart, Jordan Davis, Rachel Fairbank, and Juan Alaniz. The pandemic has affected them all. Some are working from home and teaching their kids online. Jordan Davis was furloughed from his hospitality job. Juan Alaniz applied for federal aid to help cover payroll at his PR agency. Melissa Stewart says the emotional toll of staying home feels heavy after nearly a month.
It's been very hard watching so many things not get celebrated or recognized.
Like her daughter's 10th birthday.
Her first communion, her dance recital. I'm okay for me, but it's really hard seeing my kid miss out on things.
Stewart runs the Greater Houston Restaurant Association. She says how to support restaurant owners and their employees keeps her up at night. The anxiety about reopening too fast weighs even heavier. That's backed up by local leaders. Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo told Houston Public Media last week it's not safe for business as usual until the region hits its peak number of COVID-19 cases. Even then,
if we make it past the peak and we reopen and we don't have enough testing or fast enough testing, cases are bound to reappear. Once they do, we will have to shut everything back down again. And we'll be right where we were 3 weeks ago.
Public health experts say testing is critical, and that's on the mind of Paul Alvarez. He works in the gig economy and doesn't have health insurance.
I'm afraid that if people are able to go back in any workplace, that we would be working alongside with individuals who are vectors, who are shedding the virus and have not been tested, you know, people who are asymptomatic.
Some civic leaders want more widespread testing for communities of color who've been disproportionately affected by the virus nationwide. Other measures people mentioned to me were public sanitizing stations and continued social distancing. Health has to come first, says Rachel Fairbank.
I would remind our state leaders that businesses can't be profitable if their employees and customers are sick or dying.
Abbott has pledged Texas will dramatically increase its ability to test in the coming weeks, but he hasn't released specific details. Houstonian Dries Bergman supports the governor taking a slower approach. More than anything, he thinks the state has to get it right the first time.
I don't think that folks really have the patience to do this again when we've just gone through nearly a month of social distancing already.
Otherwise, he says, the long-term costs could be far worse for Texas. I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
Well, quarantine's not keeping one of Texas's most famous performers from celebrating his favorite holiday. Willie Nelson and a bunch of friends are going to be kicking off at 4:20 this afternoon, a 4-hour and 20-minute live broadcast to benefit the Last Prisoner Project. I'm sure there will be more coming up as the day continues. Stay with us.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We're at the point of the COVID-19 pandemic in which tens of thousands of Americans are facing the kind of grief they never contemplated. One of them is the vice president of news at our partner station, KERA in Dallas, Rick Holter.
They buried my dad last week. Normally, I'd say we buried him, but this is nothing like normal. I was 1,300 miles away working remotely at my dining room table. My sister, her husband, their son, they stood in a church cemetery in Maryland, socially distanced from the pastor and the grave itself. My brother and his wife were in the grass on the other side. So were another niece and nephew. And my other brother and his wife, they left separate ends of their house, drove separate cars. At the cemetery, he didn't want to do more than crack his car window. Quarantined. 10 people, one funeral, a pandemic-sized hole in our hearts. See, Dad had COVID-19. They tested him Thursday, the day his liver gave out, the day half my family made a final visit. He died Friday. The results came back Saturday. Positive. I'm a journalist. I've read plenty of stories about nightmares in nursing homes, about the horrors of a loved one dying alone, of the daughter waving through a window, of the brother left to grieve long distance. Then it happened to me. I'm Richard Jr., the oldest of four. He was Richard Sr., Dick to his friends, dairy farmer who turned 92 last month, the day before St. Patrick's. Time of death, 3:45 in the morning, milking time. In our family, he was always the quiet one, the one who trudged out to round up the cows before dawn for 3/4 of a century, the one who spent more than a decade wheeling the love of his life and then dear friends around the retirement center, the one who was fiercely loyal to the Maryland Terrapins and whom I accompanied to ACC basketball tournaments for 30 straight years. The one who loved nothing more than sitting back with a grin while his kids, his grandkids, and then his great-grandkids chattered away at Sunday dinner. A man of deep faith and a clear tenor voice whose quiet strength won't be forgotten. The last few weeks, day after day, it's been so easy to get lost in the numbers, the confirmed cases, the ventilator counts, the deaths. My dad would have appreciated the numbers. He loved sports, loved to check the box scores in the paper every morning, loved to repeat them on the phone later that day, even if he'd read the same box score online the night before. The thing is, today, these numbers, everyone is one. Everyone is a Dick Holter. Way back, we're Norwegian Germans, a little stoic, not exactly emotional, not a lot of tears. On Sunday, 2 days after he died, I asked Alexa to play some background music. She obliged, as she always does. Then came this. 525,600 minutes. I grabbed my wife in a vicious hug.
and I broke.
For my dad, it would have been about 49,400,000 minutes, and not one of them wasted.
Rick Holter is Vice President of News for KERA North Texas. And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wealth Dunbar is monitoring social media on this Monday. What are you hearing out there, Wealth?
Hi, David. Well, we were talking about this earlier, that group of protesters against state shelter-in-place restrictions that gathered at the Texas State Capitol on Saturday. The event, which was attended by a few hundred people from across the state, was promoted by an Austin-based conspiracy theory group, InfoWars, and was one of a handful of protests in states across the nation, many of which, the Washington Post reports, were organized through Facebook by family of guns rights activists. Other national organizers of protests include Trump supporters, longtime Republican activists, and some anti-vaccine advocates. And as you and I were talking about earlier, David, back in Austin, the protesters eschewed some of the social distancing protocols. On Twitter, there's videos of InfoWars ringleader Alex Jones shaking protesters' hands, his face uncovered. So lots of chatter about whether or not this event might potentially be some sort of hotspot for potential COVID activity. On Facebook, Scott White says, "The greatest generation sacrificed so much for years to rid our world of a great evil, yet ask these so-called patriots to sacrifice a little and stay home for a few weeks, and this is what you get." And another comment on our Facebook page, this one quite popular, receiving several likes there. Kimberly Claiborne, she writes, "You can miss me with this 'we need to get back to work' argument. You can still work. Plenty of grocery stores and fast food places are hiring right now, but many won't apply. Why? Because people have always looked down on those jobs and think they're too good for them." She goes on that for the first time, many entitled and prideful people have been thrust into hardship and are now experiencing what the very people they look down upon deal with. Very interesting comment there indeed. So obviously, those events over the weekend, quite the fodder for discussion on social media, I suppose you could say there, David.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. We're getting information about a new deal that may be in the works. Congress looking for a way to cobble together more money for small business. I don't know if you heard about this,
right,
Wells, but the SBA ran out of money last week, and so now you have a lot of governors demanding and frankly business owners demanding that more be done. Something that's been really challenging for a lot of small businesses is that if you didn't already have a relationship with one of the big banks, it was difficult for you to obtain that money before all the money was already claimed by some of these other companies. And I don't know whether you saw this story about Shake Shack.
Yeah,
it's returning
back the $10 million.
Yeah.
Yeah, the owner had this really fascinating article posted, I think, on LinkedIn about their reasoning behind that, and basically saying, you know, there weren't really any instructions on who should, who shouldn't apply for this stuff. The way it was written, it was touted as something for small businesses, but even if you're a huge franchise like Shake Shack, if your individual store has less than 500 employees, that allowed them to be a beneficiary of this fund. So I know a lot of people talking about Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, which apparently received $20 million in PPP funding. You know, speaking of the economy, you hit on this earlier as well, David, that the dire state of oil prices certain to leave some economic scarring on the Texas economy. Here's a real interesting perspective on it from Christian Wallace, writer at Texas Monthly there. He has a screen cap here of the latest prices, and he says, right now, a barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude costs about the same as a 12-pack of Lone Star. So quite far away
it's
from
amazing,
many of the state projections. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very scary as well. I mean, something else that Dennis Bonner was telling me when we were talking was he's very concerned about the situation with oil prices here in Texas. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow. You can keep up with all the news at TexasStandard.org. Till then, I'm David along with Wells, wishing you a good Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.